Welcome to another season of Pro to Pro, where we sit down with entrepreneurs and successful business people and talk about their journeys to their success in their career. We go behind the scenes and have candid conversations with them and discuss health, relationships, fitness, and of course, business decisions, good and bad. If you're looking for inspiration, valuable business insights, and a dose of motivation, you're in the right place. Join me and my guests as we share our experiences, ideas, and stories that can help you on your own journey of growth and success. Welcome, and remember, keep it pro to pro. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Pro to Pro. I am here with Lori Robertson out in California. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Keith. Thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
We had some technical issues to get you started, but I'm glad we finally were able to work through those things. And I know we're 3 hours behind, so we'll hopefully not have any issues going forward. So let me get started. I mean, I got to know you briefly. We were talking a little bit ahead of time. You obviously know my wife. You've been in the aesthetic mm-hmm. space for a long time. And I think that many of our listeners and our viewers are going to be shocked with how you evolved to your career. I mean, you're a renowned national trainer. You have your own business. You have your own training academy. I mean, you've done an incredible amount of things in the aesthetic space, and you've got some strong opinions about things associated with this space that we're in, and I get involved in it on a consulting basis as well. But let's talk. What I usually do with my guests is I kind of bring them along and allow them to share how they got to where they are. And I really want to hear your story for our guests and for our listeners and our viewers as to how you got to where you are. So talk a little bit about your evolution, your family upbringing, and how you eventually decided to become an entrepreneur.
As far as my family and upbringing, it was like pretty average, normal. A couple parents, they were married until my dad passed away a few years ago. And I have one brother. And I was always going to be the nurse, and he was always going to be the doctor. I was always the dumb cheerleader. He was always the smart photographer at school. So I didn't really expect a lot of myself. You know, I went to college. I was like B student-ish. And he was always the smart one. And he went into pre-med. He was going to go into pre-med, did all finish that. And it ended up that somehow I went to Pepperdine, he went to Loma Linda. And then somehow we both ended up going to nursing school together. Now he's 2.5 years older than I am. So we had never had the opportunity to be in classes together ever. So I just knew he was the smart one. I was the cheerleader. I was not, you know, whatever, I was average. So when we started taking classes together for the first time ever in nursing school, we would constantly vie for the top grade in the class.
Oh, so you both were competitive.
I guess so. I mean, he always did well. But I mean, I think what it showed me was I wasn't as dumb as what I thought I was. And it helped open my eyes to maybe I'm not as dumb is what I thought. Maybe I'm not just the cheerleader. Maybe I can do anything I want to do. So it was interesting. That was kind of an epiphany for me that I just kind of started to look at myself in a different way.
But was school easy for you, like high school? I mean, did it just come easy, or do you think that, or did you have to really apply yourself, or were you just not necessarily like overly consumed by school? You were more consumed with social events leading up to nursing school.
More social. Yeah. Just cheerleading, football games, and having fun. And yeah, just that wasn't my focus, was being a 4.0 student. It just wasn't. So, and I never thought I ever was one. So going to school, it kind of opened my eyes that I had more upstairs than I really gave myself credit for. And then when I went to grad school, I was 4.0, which I was like, okay,
Wow. You
know, maybe I do have something up here. So it kind of opened my eyes. And I think I learned to trust myself more. I learned to maybe respect myself more for just that, rather than just being in beauty pageants. And my mother used to throw me in those things, but, and cheerleading and stuff. So I think I took myself more seriously when I realized that I really could, do well. And what's interesting is once I became a nurse practitioner, I became a nurse in 1982. If you can do the math. And I love, love, love medicine. I loved helping people. It was something I really enjoyed doing. I love putting together the pieces of the puzzle that is medicine. Medicine is like a game of Clue. There is no hardcore answer. Nothing's in concrete. You pick your assessments. You look at all of the little signs and you put them together to make your diagnoses. So that's what made it so interesting for me. And I realized I was really good at it. When I got my NP and my master's and started working as a nurse practitioner in family practice, I frequently found problems, like life-threatening problems, such as brain tumors and lung tumors, that the doc I worked with missed, because I would have that intuition and that gut instinct to do that extra test or to ask that extra question. And I always say that it's like a God-given thing I have. It's really interesting that I'm able to kind of really, medicine and I click. We just click. So how I got into aesthetics, you're kind of asking that I worked. I worked in ICU and ER for about 23 years. It was a family practice nurse practitioner in private practice for about 3 years, and then went and got Botox somewhere. And when I did, I kind of sat down in the office and I looked around and I go, huh, this is kind of casual. The doc has time to talk with me and sit and chit chat. There's nice music playing in the background. And I'd never, ever had this opportunity ever in any of the specialties I had worked in. So I asked him, I'm like, are you hiring? He's like, yeah, I am. And I said, okay, let me go to a couple meetings first, conferences. I want to learn more about this. So I did. And I had no idea what they were talking about. None. So I went to those conferences, learned a little bit. And I'm like, it really piqued my interest. So I went back and said, okay, you know, I think I'd like to kind of check this out, maybe work part-time doing this. So I worked part-time in aesthetics and family practice. I didn't want to let go of family practice for about 3 or 4 months. And then I went ahead and left family practice and went into aesthetics full-time. And that was 2007. So yeah.
So you were essentially, you got immersed in aesthetics kind of in a period of time where it was just starting to grow.
Oh.
Right?
Oh,
I mean yeah. It was kind of new. I mean, if I think back during that period of time, and obviously there was plastic surgery, there was all these things, you know, that people would be able to do, but the boat, I don't know the year, you probably know, what was the year that Botox kind of became in vogue? Was that about that time period or just before that time period?
I think the Carruthers and some other people, as far as the research, I think it was in the late 90s, early 2000s, but didn't really become popular until a few years later. What's interesting that you bring up is that I was in the newer, I didn't know. I didn't know really what I was getting into. And I had a PA start teaching me things. I was there 3 days a week, and I was more afraid to do Botox than I was fillers. So if that tells you where research wasn't back then,
yeah.
We didn't have hyaluronidase. We didn't have occlusions. Nobody's ever heard of that stuff, really. So I wasn't afraid to do fillers. I just stuck it in wherever I was stuck in. And thank God, didn't have a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've been really lucky to be able to read research along the way, go to conferences along the way, and learn along the years slowly and assimilate it and absorb it slowly. It's pretty tough for people who just start in injecting to soak all of this in, because there's so much research and there's so much to know that to be a safe injector, that you really, really have to do your due diligence and get your head in those books and didactics and conferences and hands-on education before you can really be a safe injector or knowledgeable injector.
It's an area that I know we're going to talk about with regard to experience and basic foundational medical training and knowledge. It begs the question, I mean, as far as what you shared with us, you have a foundation of experience in yourself in working all those years in medicine, in traditional medicine to begin with, before you elected to go into the aesthetic field.
Absolutely. And Keith, it has literally saved lives. Because I had that background, and I won't hire a provider who hasn't worked for a few years in acute care. I won't. I truly believe that we're healthcare practitioners first. We are we are treating our patient. We are still providers. It's not just Botox. I'll tell you what happened a few years back is that a gentleman came in to get his Dysport. We were just chatting. No problems. He's healthy. Great. He was terrific. And we're just chatting. And I'm like, hey, well, what's new? What's happening? What's new? And he said, well, I'm on an antibiotic. I'm like, oh, okay, no problem. What do you want? Well, I'm on an antibiotic, whatever he mentioned, for my throat. I said, okay. Did you have a sore throat? No. I said, did you have fever or chills, something? He's like, no, I just have this bump here. And I said, So I started feeling it. And I said, is this lump tender? And he said, no. Red flags were going up in my head. I thought, oh my gosh, this guy had no acute infectious symptoms. And somebody, a doctor he went to, put him on antibiotics. And the day I saw him, I sent him to an ENT and I sent him in for an ultrasound of his neck. And it was adenocarcinoma of the jugular digastric gland. So it was lymphatic cancer, and the doc he had gone to had blown it off. And I see that time and time and time again. I was so frustrated in urgent care and family practice to see providers lazy. I think it's negligent to blow things off, because I think if you find something, you have to do something about it. And that's why I'm such a proponent of nurse practitioners. We have better outcomes, period.
Yeah, I know. And more patients, no pun intended, generally speaking, with regard to really being comprehensive in that regard. And I hate the term that has come about, this mid-level. People call nurse practitioners, physicians, associates, mid-levels. I just think it's a terrible, I think it discredits the role of one. And I know that in different states, there's been lobbyists and there's attempts to increase the ability of independence in that area. But you have the AMA and you have a lot of the doctors pushing back at that because they're afraid. At the end of the day, it's about the mighty dollar.
And
that's what seems to take hold of everything. Let me move to I know we'll jump around a little bit, but I'm excited to talk about some of the things you shared with me leading up to this podcast. You had a very interesting journey with regard to your career leading up to the position that you're in now. You shared with me your work out in Hollywood, so to speak, and you were also involved. I think you said the military, or there was something that you did, or as a police officer, you did something. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Being a nurse, I've done several things kind of while I was a nurse, in essence. So I ended up having a good friend of mine who I went to Pepperdine with, who ended up working for an agency in Los Angeles. And years later, she contacted me and said, hey, MGM is looking for a nurse to play a nurse on a show. And I said, oh, no, you know what? I did drama in high school. No. So she called me and she's like, please just audition. So I auditioned for it and I ended up getting the part. And we did a show called Group One Medical for about a year. But what that did for me was it connected me with a director who directed General Hospital part-time. And he said, hey, our show's... Yeah,
I don't know if it's still on, but for the people who may or may not know, the soap opera General Hospital. I remember it when I was in college. Yep.
So I talked to him and he got me connected with the executive producer and the director of that at that time. So I went and interviewed with them, and because I was union and for actually a part. And they said, you know what? We really like your hospital background. So I worked in ICU at the time. And we really like your hospital background, and we really need a new medical consultant for our show. Would you consider being the medical consultant and going over all the scripts and the dialogue and writing the dialogue and ordering the props? But you're union, so we could put you on as a nurse. And it might be good because, if we give you a big part, then we could kill you off. But being a medical consultant might be a little bit longer life. I'm like, that's perfect. That's perfect. So I was a medical consultant for that show for 19 years, but I played a nurse on the show in all of the OR, ICU, ER scenes, all of that. I played a nurse on the show. So sometimes I would talk, sometimes I wouldn't, but I was able to really have an impact on a lot of the long-term storylines. We did a great HIV storyline when AIDS was big in the 80s. We did a breast cancer storyline. We did a pediatric transplant, heart transplant storyline. We did some really, really good storylines that had good, meaty medical information and did put PSAs after these shows that said, if you want to be an organ donor, contact here. So we had some really good stuff. On the flip side, there's this little ID that all of the writers and the directors carry, and it's this little creative license, and they can trump me at any time. So when they would have someone that say, like, get in an accident, they break their neck, and then they get a medicine like Decadron, and then they can walk miraculously after being paralyzed.
Yeah.
I would say no, take my name off the credits and take the medication name off of there and name it something like PR-123. So it's not a real drug, because there are people that are out there vacuuming their floors and babysitting kids and whatever. There's people out there who kind of believe this.
Yeah, impressionable. Sure.
I would never want to mislead people, but it all has to do with drama. I learned very quickly it is all about drama, but a lot of the time they would listen to me and they would help me. I could rewrite the scripts and put appropriate medical information in there time and time again, which really I think helps people learn a little bit. I mean, it's nothing like Grey's Anatomy, but it is what it is. So
wow,
that was fun.
What a story. Wow. And then so that was obviously prior to your aesthetic world that you entered in the aesthetic world. So fast forward after that, you left that and then you were doing some other things leading up to your aesthetics, correct?
Yeah. So while I was doing that, actually, I went through the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Academy when I was still in ICU. So about a year, I had been in ICU for about a year. So about 1983, I went through the academy. And I was taken on to, I had to work with a mountain rescue team, San Dimas Mountain Rescue Team here in Southern California for a year before they had to trust me that I was able to rappel and belay others up online when we had to rappel and get injured hikers or lost people. So I had to work with the team for about a year before they even let me go through the academy. So I went through that academy. My brother and I went through at the same time. So and I were both nurses. We were both RNs at the time, and we worked on mountain rescue and for about 3 years. Then he went over to narcotics. I went over to underwater dive recovery in the LA area with what the sheriff's department is called the ESD, which is Emergency Services Detail. So it's kind of like SWAT kind of a thing. So I worked out of the helicopters a lot, did underwater dive recovery for about 10 and a half years before my husband begged me to retire. About a year after we had our second child, he's like, please don't fly in the helicopters anymore. He calls them rocks with props. So I did. I retired from the department in about 97.
That's amazing. So what was your, when you retired, what was your rank?
I stayed as a deputy.
So tell me a little bit more about the helicopter runs and the issues that you were having as you were, you were a mother at the time too. And I don't blame your husband from being concerned.
Well, I had a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old. So they're 4 years apart. But he asked me, he's like, please don't fly in the helicopters anymore. And I loved it. I loved rappelling out of the helicopters and going down the mountains and getting lost people. And I enjoyed all of it. And the team was really a good team. It was a really, really good team. So I retired out in 97 from the sheriff's department. And I had lots of really neat memories, and it taught me a lot. A lot of discipline, taught me a lot of discipline, respect for others. And I was able to use my medical knowledge to help others that had, it could be lost hikers. It could be people who had fallen down a river, or people in the lake who had, a lot of them sometimes dead bodies, drownings and such, or murders and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, there's lots of different stuff that we found. So, what's interesting, Keith, is working in ICU and ER, family practice, the patients were already packed up, wrapped up, and that's how I got them. ER, paramedics got to them, wrapped them up, and I got them and took care of them. ICU, they had gone to surgery and come back. Okay, I wasn't ever in a situation where I would be standing over a murdered body, which it was something that was so eye-opening, and it really hit me to the core of, I'm standing over this body that somebody shot in the back of the head, arms and legs are duct taped together, they kicked him down a hill. And the only reason we found him is because we could smell. It was 100 degrees in California. And the animals had partially eaten this person. And when I got, I had to go down there with a coroner because none of my other colleagues could handle the smell. So we went down there and retrieved the body. And just staying there and looking at something like this, and it made what we see and hear on the news so horribly real.
Yeah, I could only imagine.
We're so desensitized to what we hear. Like three people were killed and one person got shot and a family got, you know, went off a cliff in a car. We're so desensitized to that we've separated ourselves from all the trauma and the horrible stuff that happens in our world. But when you're standing over it and it's right in your face, it really touches you to the core. I'll never forget finding some of those murdered individuals.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because my wife, my wife was former law enforcement before she got into the medical field.
That's
as
how
well.
We connect.
Yeah. And she shared with me, she said, when she had to deal with a dead body, she still can have, there's a smell, a decomposition smell that she cannot get out of her mind or her thought process. So I couldn't even imagine. I feel blessed that she's not doing that anymore, because I wouldn't be able to handle it, especially in today's day and age when there's a complete lack of respect for the role of law enforcement. It's really unfortunate. I could have a whole podcast on that in and of itself.
I was going to say, don't get me started.
Yeah, and you're out in California too, which is...
It's lack of respect. And I don't know what it is. If this is how we've grown this generation, but it's lack of respect for everything. Yeah. It's for people's property. It's for law enforcement. It's for authority. It's for life in general. And I'm dumbfounded. I think it's a lack of respect for anything around them and a sense of entitlement. If I'll take this, I want it.
Yeah, I think,
don't get me started.
I know we can get into the conversations, but it's a good segue because it gets into this disposable world in which we appear to live in at times. And you nailed it with the entitlement aspect of things and the swipe left or swipe right, just swiping and being able to move on and not really having a conviction and staying power to be able to consistently work on something that you want to get. And we have a lot of these discussions on the podcast. People, they love the stories of folks like you about how you got to where you are. And for whatever reason, some people think it just happens overnight and there's no, hard work involved. But I'm trying to share with our guests to our social media platforms how hard it is to get to the positions that, our guests are in. And they too, our listeners and our viewers can get there, but it's not going to be because you're entitled to it or because, you deserve it. You're going to have to work towards it. Did you ever think in a million years that you were going to become a business owner or the role that you're in now at all growing up?
No.
So how did
you get? I figured I was just going to be a nurse in a hospital.
Yeah. How did you make that transition or what was the catalyst to get you into that particular position that you're in now?
You know, it's funny you should ask that, because my husband and I, we drove past an office of a physician I used to work with, which is one of them that missed diagnoses, and I would catch those diagnoses. So she pulled me in one day, and I worked in family practice for about 3 years, and she pulled me in one day and said, you know what? We don't need you anymore. My patients were my life. I went in early. I stayed late. I was so incredibly dedicated to what I was doing. I was flabbergasted. And she's like, no, it's a business decision. We're just going to keep this one PA and we're going to let you go. And I figured probably it's because I found quite a few things that she missed, probably. And she was shy and probably easily threatened is the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was destroyed.
Oh, I bet.
I was destroyed. I didn't know what I was going to do. It was horrible, horrible. And for years, I was still just dumbfounded. Like, why did she do that? I felt bad. I didn't want to leave my patients. So it ended up sending me on a different trajectory. And I always say that horrible things in your life that you don't think you can get out of, you don't think you can get around, oftentimes force you to go into a different direction, because I would never have even thought of going into aesthetics. Are you kidding me? Like, yeah, I'm going to get Botox after I've done ICU and Mountain Rescue and ER. Really? So I never would have thought about that, but it sent me into this other trajectory where I had a more open mind, and it let me have an open mind to look at something more openly and then go into that field. And we drove by that office yesterday, my husband and I did. And I said, you know what? Someday I should go in there and thank that doc. Thank you for what you did, because you sent me in a different direction, which has actually helped me be more. I've learned more. I've helped others more, other providers, patients, and it has helped me grow in ways that I never dreamed of.
That's an incredible. That is one of the big themes on the podcast that many of our guests talk about, the pivot. The wall that comes in front of them and the devastation associated with it, and then the ability to walk through that wall or walk around that wall and able to move forward. And it requires a lot of self-reflection. It requires, mm-hmm. obviously, you had the support of your spouse at the time, yeah. but it really I think in the long run, it creates this sense of purpose, in that you probably learned that innately you were no longer going to allow yourself to rely or be controlled by someone else. So in other words, with that flippant response of that practitioner saying to you, we no longer need you anymore, and the devastation, because you were essentially the company person. You were doing everything on behalf of the company, predicated on the passion that you had in medicine, and you weren't thinking of the dollars, so to speak, of it. You were doing what you loved. And many people do rely on their employer and are doing what they want to do. And there's nothing wrong with that. But for whatever reason, you know, God's intervention or whatever it was for the time came and I'm sure it was very difficult in the beginning. I've been through a similar circumstance as well when I had a hastened separation from the corporate world, which ended up being the best thing that ever happened to me. And then fast forward, then I had an issue with an ex-partner that ended up being the best thing that ever happened to me. But when you're in it in real time, it's hard for you to reconcile all those feelings. But the one feeling is that you say to yourself, I'm not going to allow somebody else to control my fate. And that was the catalyst for you, I believe.
Right. It was interesting because I had the secondary issue too. So I worked in aesthetics for years, and then I did have a partner for about 5 years that wasn't a great partner. This is in aesthetics. This is 2012 to 2017, and not the partner I have now. He's wonderful, but it ended up that this person ended up being a significant narcissist, and I have never been around a narcissist, so I didn't understand the manipulation. You know, they're very smart.
I didn't
understand that. And pitting us against each other, the girls that worked at the med spa, and I didn't see it. I didn't look for it, but I finally just said, I've had enough of you. He was disrespectful, rude. So I've had enough of you. And I left that practice. I gave him about 3 months to find another provider to fill my backspace, and then left 2 weeks. When he asked me to come work with him, he gave me 30% of the business, which was one med spa. We built that from probably $500,000 business up to about $1.2 million in 1 year. And then we opened up a total in the 5 years of 4 small med spas. So I had 30%, 33% of 4 small med spas. So 2 weeks after I left him, and I thought, I'm just going to open my own med spa somewhere. You know, he owes me probably upwards of $1 million. I'll just open my own med spa. Within 2 weeks, and I had no job, I'd gone nowhere, he, with a swipe of his pen, there was something in my contract that stated for any reason he could take away my shares and give them to the medical director.
Oh my gosh.
So he did. And my lawyer missed it. I didn't read the contract. I didn't see that. But going back through it, she saw it and I saw it. And it's a bummer. nothing you can do about it. So what I did was went and opened my own clinic with my previous work coworker, Will Gideon, who's Dr. Kwok, who's my partner now. He's awesome. So he said, "Hey, Lori, we want to open another clinic. Why don't you just own it? It's fine. You open it, be part of the Skin Perfect family, and you open it. And so that's what I did. I opened that with no patients. I didn't take one patient. It's a mile from the previous clinic. Not one person knew where I was going, which I don't think that's ethical. I just don't. And we have never been in the red. It's always been fine. We started slow. It's very generic and we started slow. So when the ex-partner came and wanted to discuss things with me, he came into my lobby. That's as far as I let him go. He didn't see the rest of the 4,300 square feet that I was leasing out. And basically he was like, "Yeah, you took all these patients." I said, "No, I didn't take one. And you can look and see all the patients are still going to be calling, looking for me. And I didn't take one." And basically I just said at the end of a conversation, I said, "You are nothing more than a life lesson to me. You're a life lesson. I've learned a lot about narcissism. I've learned a lot about how I don't want to manage my clinics. I've learned about how I don't want to manage employees. So I'm going to take that with me because that's been a big lesson. And I don't need to hate you. I don't need to stay angry at you. That only hurts me because I'm not your last judge."
And many people, that's incredible, Lord. Many people don't have that opportunity of full circle in that particular circumstance. I mean, that's incredible. Again, he validated his narcissism by coming to see you again, obviously thinking that he was going to be able to, spit it somehow or do something with you, intimidate you. But what a wonderful story. So how did you end it with him?
So he just sat there kind of wide-eyed, and I think it hit him that I'm not his last judge. He has somebody much bigger to account to. And he left and you know what? I'll tell you what, that was another pivot point for me because that was horrible. He took away all my retirement. I'm like, that was my retirement. I'd worked so, so hard to build up these clinics for 5 years. He wouldn't hire a manager. He said, "Lori, the clinics run themselves. You just see patients." So I did everything, hiring, firing, inventory. I did everything and saw patients. So like I said, it's not how he taught me how I don't want to run a clinic. So, we started my clinic and like you said, it did open my eyes to like, no, I want to be able to have my own rules. I want to be able to run it how I want to run it. I don't want commissions illegal anyway. And 99% or 98% of the clinics out there do give medical providers commission, which is illegal. You can talk to that, but I don't want commission. I don't want to take any focus off that patient and on the dollar. We want to educate patients. And we say like Leslie Fletcher, I think she's trademarked this EduSell. I think she trademarked that. So I have to give her credit for that. But I love that because we're educating and we are selling, but we're educating and giving that patient the option to do or to not do a treatment we might recommend. And when I don't make money on the back end from something that I am doing, that's not my focus. My focus stays on that patient, 1000%. And you know what? That has blessed me beyond measure because that's where we get a lot of referrals. Patients trust us. They know that we're there for them, not for the dollar. Much of the time I'll say, "Nope, you don't need it yet. Come back in 6 months. Let's look at you in 6 months." And they so appreciate the honesty that we provide to them. So they refer friends and we have a lot of, and referrals are some of the strongest patients you get when you have a referral. So it's been the best thing that ever happened.
I bet. And this goes to some other topics that we talk about, like when there's going to be people who are listening to the podcast that are, considering going into, aesthetics, opening up their own spa. I'm actually going to be speaking about this in June at a conference. And so when I had my wife on, one of the topics we talked about was, how she wanted to approach the business and how she wanted to practice. And it seems clear to me that your approach and my wife's approach are parallel with regard to patient care and what needs to be done. Part of her approach too related to the fact that she recognized her comfort with debt, that she was going to handle patients the way she wanted to handle patients and not be beholden to services in order to, you know, feed the monster of debt, feed the monster of lasers, feed the monster of overhead, right. Things like that.
Right.
There was no compromise in how she wanted to do things, which sounds to me you did the same thing. And you learned substantially through your experience from this narcissist how you weren't going to approach things.
So, you know, what's interesting, Keith, is we don't get business classes in school. We don't get business classes in nursing school. In medical school, really. So when you open your own clinic and you have fixed liabilities, you have liabilities that are not fixed, you've got net, you've got gross, you've got all these legal mumbo jumbos to jump through. What an eye opener is that? And most people think that when you own a med spa, you're making tons of money. They don't realize that your net might be 20%. So how can you give 50% of your filler, you know, cost to an employee, like a commission or whatever? You can't and survive. So people don't realize all the business aspects to running a clinic. And I'll tell you what, the first person I hired when I opened my new clinic, I had, my clinic is 4,300 square feet. My lease was about $12,000 a month. I had no money from my previous job because he took it all.
Yeah.
So I think that was the biggest leap of faith. I'm like, God, help me out here, because this is the biggest leap of faith that I have ever had. And it was just, I just trusted that he was going to provide, and he did. First person I hired was a manager. No patients, a manager. So, who was exactly what he said I never needed.
Yeah, yeah.
My manager, I trust with my life. And she, I always say it's her clinic. I just work in it because I found somebody phenomenal who watches my bottom line. She watches the dollars. She does everything. She's phenomenal. And that means the world to me.
Oh, it's so much peace of mind. But let's get into a topic that relates to the clinics, you know, opening a business and the challenges running a business. Let's talk a little bit about Instagram, because Instagram or any social media platform for that matter, because what's happening in today's society that we see time in and time out is we know how these social platforms can attract all different types of individuals. And we see, especially in the aesthetic practice, where You mentioned earlier referrals are a strong basis for your revenue. And we know that practitioners utilize the platforms to showcase their work, showcase what they're doing, showcase the patients, different type of services that are available, things like that. And obviously, you've built a bank over the years of experience and training and knowledge, and you have the subject matter expertise, and you have the foundation from your clinical studies and your experiences over the years in medicine itself to, you know, be able to showcase that and speak and teach. Instagram has allowed injectors to skip steps, or providers to skip steps in essentially developing a following predicated on, you know, misguided and ignorant or naive potential patients. And talk a little bit about that, because we've had some good conversations regarding this topic. I deal with it on the liability end after the fact. I deal with it sometimes in the beginning and trying to help build up businesses and ensuring that these folks have the requisite training. But talk a little bit about that and your feeling about that particular area.
Oh, we're going to open a can of worms here.
That's what we do.
Well,
let's do it.
I'll tell you, you know what? I say that social media is the best and the worst of medical aesthetics. Being the best, we can really educate. We can help educate patients. We can help educate providers. We can get good information out there. And I get consults in my office almost every day from Instagram, because they connect with me. So I love that people can kind of almost interview and vet you on Instagram when you're doing education and explaining things, and they'll come in and they fit. It's almost like water seeks its own level. I don't get people who want the gigantic lips.
Let me interrupt you for a second, because I bring this up a lot. What I believe the platform has done, and one of the reasons I started the podcast itself and got involved in social media, it does expedite substantially the relationship. In other words, the trusting of the relationship, in that they think they know you more because they've seen you in so many settings. And if you're authentic with how you present and what you do, it really shortens the learning curve. And in an attorney-client relationship, it's tremendous. And in a physician-patient relationship, medical provider-patient. Mm-hmm. So you nailed it with regard to that, but it's got its downside. And let's get into that as well.
Yeah. So for downside, it's nothing but smoke and mirrors. I see them all the time. I see providers who are newer at what they're doing, but they have a great social media manager, and it makes them look like they have been doing it for years, that they're safe, and they get this huge Instagram following when they have sometimes an incredibly shady past. And there's a few out there like that. They might have a couple hundred thousand Instagram followers, but basically, it's smoke and mirrors. And if they have huge complications, they send them to someone else who knows what they're doing. And this is all the time. This is not once in a while. They just have a really good social media person that puts everything out there that people love, like pictures of the Kardashians or whatever, and it looks good. And that's where it goes. So the issue I have with this is, number one, it misleads patients. Patients are going to some of these people who really don't have a lot of experience or knowledge or expertise in either what they're doing or handling complications, which we have to know how to handle complications. When there's a problem, you can't ignore it and have someone's face fall off, which I've seen with a national trainer. And you can't always send it to someone else who's going to try to rescue you. You need to be responsible for your patients. The other thing is, some of these conferences are falling for this. Some of the companies are falling for this. So we have big pharmaceutical companies and we have conferences that are looking at these Instagram people who either are half dressed.
Yeah. And they're dancing. It is what it is.
In clubs. I think when we're professionals, we have to know that's who we are. People will always look at us. I should say they're always going to expect something from us.
You're being kind and dancing around it. I'll be a little bit more blunt about it. I think that what I've observed, I've been involved in this. My wife started the practice a little over 10 years ago. I've been involved. I've gone to conferences. I've seen it. I'm now being immersed in social media. It's a popularity contest, and there's a complete blur of being a professional medical provider and being Instagram famous, based upon, you know, tits and ass or whatever you want to consider is there. Champagne, cars, things, purses, trips, things that really mean nothing as far as life is concerned. They're just things, objects. And it's use the term Kardashian world, use whatever term you want. You especially see it probably a lot in California as well. But unfortunately, it discredits the disparate licensures and professions of individuals who are earnest and like you, like my wife, like many of the other people that I've come in contact with that truly are in a profession that they love. But at the end of the day, they're medical practitioners, and they are providing this aesthetic service as an arm of as a medical practitioner, and not sacrificing their ethics and their morals for the buck. That's basically what it comes down to.
Keith, you hit it. You hit the nail on the head. It discredits us. And when I go to a conference and I see an RN up on stage with a skin tight, sparkly bodysuit that's cut down to the waist doing a lecture, I go, am I a prude? Or is this totally inappropriate when you're doing a professional lecture? And they might know what they're talking about. They might have experience, but it's just, I don't understand that. I don't get it. I'm like, where's that coming from? I guess that's not the attention that I want to receive, but I would rather get it from my brain and what I have to offer and my experience. The other thing is what I mentioned about conferences. where a lot of these conferences and like the pharmaceutical companies are looking at these Insta-famous people, and they are taking them and putting them up in the spotlight. And they're taking these people and putting them up in lecturing. And when you go and listen to them, they're giving out wrong information. They're not even giving out the right information on podium. So a lot of us who have been in this for years, there are certain conferences I'm not going to it. If they want to go for the Instagram people that are famous, who don't have experience, who give out wrong information on podium, no. So I think providers need to really use a critical thinking and really look hard at who's giving the information, and always think about the why of, could that be right? Could that be wrong? Where'd that come from? Where'd they get that idea? Where's the research to back it up? So this is a really interesting time we're living in.
Oh, it is. I mean, I see it all the time. I mean, people pop up these training academies out of the blue, and then, you know, they've been an injector for a year or so, and all of a sudden they start their own training academy, and people are going to them. And you know, what is the term master injector? What does that mean, master injector, when you don't necessarily, there is none. But people hold themselves out that way. Yeah. I can parallel this discussion with cosmetic surgeons and plastic surgeons. It's the same issue that develops where there's a lack of understanding of the general public. I believe part of the challenge is the fact you've got big pharma, you've got these multi-billion dollar organizations that don't necessarily care where their product is going, you know, as long as it's volume based, you know, so they don't care on their end of it. From the purist side, there, for me, and I know that you believe in this too, there should be some form of national recognition. There should be some form of accountability established. We know of accountability and licensure restraints associated with various professions, whether it be an NP, whether it be a physician associate, whether it be a lawyer, whether it be a medical doctor, but they're disparate, right? They're not in line with this aesthetic world because it wasn't necessarily contemplated that this would occur. So now we're in this world in which the public don't know. And at the end of the day, there should be protection of the general public. There needs to be accountability. My wife handles complications. My wife handled a complication from a derm office that they didn't even have, I forget the dissolving agent, what it's called.
Hyalinex.
They didn't even have Hyalinex. And I actually contacted, I remember I contacted Vice President of Legal at Allergan, and I spoke to him, and I said to him, do you have any mandates within Allergan that requires your subscribers, your providers who buy your product to have the dissolving agent on site?
Nope.
And he laughed at me. Nope. He said, that's not our issue. We don't have that liability. The practice should have that liability, not us. But again, unsuspecting public goes in there. They don't know what's going on. They're not there. And this poor lady, thank goodness my wife was there to be able to take care of it and saved her face. But these are things that we see on our end, right? That people, Instagram, we don't put the negative on Instagram, right? People don't, they don't see that aspect of what we deal with. But it needs to be discussed and it needs to be confronted somehow, some way. So what are some of your thoughts? I mean, we could talk about problems, complaints, and things like that. What are some of your thoughts on how potentially in the aggregate things could be done to impact the change?
I want to figure out a way that we can do a board certification for medical aesthetics, irregardless of degree. I don't care if you're a physician, I don't care if you're a plastic surgeon, I don't care if you're an RN, you take the same test and you get the same board certification. I think that should be mandatory, but I just don't know of a organization that will take responsibility for that. Would it be American Academy of Family Practice Physicians? Who would it be that would govern that? Because somebody's going to have to take responsibility for that. Once we could get a certification that PAs, it doesn't matter who it is, you go into aesthetics, you take this test, it's going to denote a foundational amount of knowledge, not expertise, but at least that foundational knowledge of assessment and complication management and all the things we need to know will be in that test. Then we have to market that to the public. So the public knows, don't go to anybody that doesn't have this certification, right? So then at least they're going to pick somebody who has at least the foundational knowledge. There's one organization called ISPAN. It's the International Society of Plastic and Aesthetic Nurses. They have a test called CANS, the Certified Aesthetic Nurse Specialist Test. Amazing. It's a vetted test. It's a tough test. You've got to work in aesthetics for a while. You've got to have your time in. You've got there's a lot of prerequisites, which I love, to even sit and take the test. And that CANS certification is excellent. The problem with it is that only nurses can take the exam.
And also PAs, you have to be sponsored, right? Don't you also have to be sponsored?
Here's the deal is I'm on faculty with ISPAN. I speak at the conferences. I can't sit for the exam because my medical director isn't plastic or derm. So if my medical director isn't a plastic surgeon, I can't even take the exam. So that knocks out 80% of the nurses out there, nurse practitioners, that could be CAN certified. I just want this certification to go much broader than just nurses. But I love, love, love that they've taken that bull by the horns. They've got a governing body who is going to watch over it. But that's also the governing body who only wants nurses to take the test.
So yeah, there's proprietary issues. I've had some issues with CANS on behalf of some of my clients as well. I think that the intent is good in the aggregate, like you said. However, the proprietary nature of it and the seclusion of it, I think, you know, it fights against some of these things that you were addressing from a global perspective.
Yeah, I think it's something, it's something that we have so many injectors who go to a weekend course and they open their own clinic. They have no idea what they're doing. I get DMs from them all the time. Hey, Lori, can you look at this? Can you look at this? What do you think about this? And I'm like, I don't really want to say anything other than like, here's what happens when I treat patients when I do something like this in my clinic. I don't want to medically diagnose on social media. So I get a lot of questions and I ask them, I go, don't you have a mentor? You know, you've taken three courses and now you opened your own clinic and you don't know this basic stuff. Don't you have a mentor? Don't you have somebody near you who you could ask questions of? And they have no idea. I mean, Keith, you wouldn't believe that I go to conferences and I have people walk up to me all the time like, hi, I'm Betty and I'm Sarah and we're both nurse practitioners and we're taking this conference on this weekend because we're all set to open our clinic next month to start aesthetics. And I'm like, okay, how many classes have you taken? How long have you worked in aesthetics? Oh, we're new.
Yeah, we had this conversation.
My heart stops.
Yeah, wife and I had this conversation last week about the fact that they go to school strictly for aesthetics. And, you know, I have a philosophical issue, and my wife does as well, with the fact that you can go from nursing school directly to become an NP. You know, that there's no there should be some type of working at one level before you advance to the next level. And that doesn't take place. And again, it relates to revenue of the schools, right? We know that the schools want to make money and they under the guise of more providers for society, but there's always going to be these folks, like you suggested, that will just do it strictly for aesthetic purposes, which is, you know, a real challenge.
And I think I 1,000% agree with the nurse should have experience before going in to get the NP. I had 23 years of experience. I can't tell you how much that helped me when I worked in family practice. And I think that's what made me such a good practitioner and find things the doctors missed. And if you think about it, when doctors come out of medical school, because I worked with family practice residents all the time, and every July in ICU, I'd be like, God, they're going to kill somebody because they have no idea what they're doing. When they get out of medical school, they have no idea what they're doing. They haven't developed assessment skills. They don't have a gut instinct. They don't have that. It takes years to develop that. Same with PAs. When PAs get out there, they're just like that brand new doctor. They haven't developed those skills yet. An NP, if you have an RN going straight through the NP program, they haven't developed those. So they're just like a PA or an MD that gets out of school that don't, you haven't developed the gut instinct and those really good fine-tune those assessment skills that we need to take care of patients. So that's why I so agree with you that I really think if you have an NP that's had years of an experience as an RN and then they go get their NP, heads and shoulders above anybody else. I think that MDs and PAs catch up, but it takes them years to catch up.
The other issue that seems to impact the industry substantially is the equity groups that have come into the space and want to acquire the businesses or kind of amass much larger entities, buying up practices all over the place. And you've obviously been able to keep yourself at bay from them, but I'm sure you constantly get contacted for that as well. And I know that sometimes what'll happen in that particular setting is that, so people will, again, it comes down to the mighty dollar, right? They'll think about like a 5X or a 10X return on their practice to go, you know, in light of this particular expectation within these equity groups. Talk a little bit about that and the impact in the industry.
This has been interesting. It's all money. It's all they see, these private equity groups see bucks in the medical aesthetics, and they think it's an easy way to make money. So what they do is they go and they buy them up, and then they have the practitioner stay for probably a couple of years, and then they promise them monopoly money at the end. Because if you stay here and if the business grows and you're going to get X amount of money at the end of this when you step out in a couple of years, but that might not ever happen. That's just like Bitcoin, you know, so whatever, or monopoly money. That might not ever happen. So you have these people that are selling to these private equity groups. You have to make sure that whatever you get initially, you can walk away with and be happy with, because chances are you're not going to get any more. The other thing is their focus is totally different. What is the focus of a private equity group? Money. What's the focus of a good practitioner? The patient. So it turns that business focus around to the wrong focus for medicine. I mean, heck, go buy Starbucks or something. You know, go buy something else that's service related, but not medicine, because it turns it around into the wrong focus. So the providers and everything have to change their focus because they've got to make more money to make everybody happy within the equity group. So it's unfortunate that this is kind of happening. And I think there might be, right now it's kind of on the rise, and I have a feeling it's going to kind of mellow out. You know, it depends on kind of where things go, but I don't know, we'll see how things turn out. But I know of a lot of my colleagues who have sold to these groups, and they get a good chunk initially, and they think they're getting another big chunk later. And I'm like, just go open your Monopoly game take some of that money out.
I've seen it representing some clients as well. It's like anything else in life, right? If it's too good to be true, it probably is. And it is negotiating as much as possible on the front end, but they have clawback provisions a lot of times in these agreements, in which they'll do an aggregate of the year end, and it could be a potential where money may be going the other way, depending upon the circumstances. And again, you do transpose your focus from patient care and patient outcomes to money and revenue, which again, the industry is just, I always use this term, and it seems to be resonates with everybody when I speak to them. It's this cowboys and Indians world that we're in with regard to aesthetics. It's just, there's really no rules at times with regard to things. And you have so many multiple players from all different backgrounds coming in and making an impact, positive or negative, within the industry. It's just, to me, mind boggling at times what we go through. And, you know, I attempt to reconcile the regulatory impacts where the states, because I have a consulting practice that I do some work in, you know, nationally in other, representing other injectors, other providers. And you've got instances, of course, where you have, like in your state, where you have to be a medical doctor, an MD, in order to own a practice, the majority of the practice. But then what's been developed is these MSOs that come into play. Well, some states, like in Florida, for example, you can own a practice and not be a medical provider. You don't even have to be in the medical, have a medical education to own a practice. Oh. But the folks that are running the practice, they need to be medical. If you're dispensing, if you're involved in any type of medical aspect of providing care, you have to have that licensure. So there's a lot of so many different laws that are in place. And what happens in your industry is that the laws can't keep up with the progressive change of so many different things between technology and these various products that are created. And then you have the FDA's involvement to an extent in some respects, And then, you know, you have people, because it's such a global enterprise, you have other countries that allow certain things. And so you have folks going across the border to have things done. And then you have practitioners here who are bringing things over that they shouldn't bring over. And you deal with the challenges of that with patients. It is like, when I say cowboys and Indians, I truly mean it. It's very frustrating at times to have to try and counsel and manage folks, because their limited understanding is like, well, why can't I do that? So-and-so down the street is doing that. They're not playing by the rules. And of course, when you come to, you know, a lawyer or somebody who's got their interest in mind, they don't like necessarily what we're saying, but we're trying to protect them from the industry and from the issues.
I think it's interesting that you bring up things like this, where we've got, you have to know your scope of practice. You have to know your laws in your state. And if you don't, shame on you, because you're responsible for it. But here's the deal. It's like, some of these laws that are in the Board of Registered Nursing, and some, they put them in so deeply and they're so convoluted, you can't even find some of these rules and regulations. That happens with OSHA and laser safety. Good luck finding all the rules with having a laser. You know, there's not, you can't find them, but they'll come in, they'll nail you for it, because they'll find the rule and they'll bring it up for you. Yeah. Like in California, nurse practitioners are going to have independence starting this year. Okay. So we can have our own business. We don't need a medical director. Do you want me to tell you what 99.9% of nurse practitioners don't know? It doesn't cover medical aesthetics. So nurse practitioners are going to think that I'm independent. I can open my own practice, and they're going to get nailed. So there's so many different things that it's important that every provider knows their personal state laws and their scope of practice.
It's so important. I do these consults with folks who want to get into the industry. The elementary aspect of the practice regarding medical directors and supervisors, it is prevalent where they'll skip steps. In other words, they'll go, my dad is a doctor. My uncle, you know, twice removed, is a doctor. That person could be my medical director, right? That, you know, that person, what we could, no. In the state of Florida, people don't realize you got to be a plastic surgeon or a derm. And those providers are limited in how many practices they can be medical directors of, and they're limited in scope as far as distance is concerned. But at the end of the day, don't you want someone who you can actually converse with as it relates to complications, as it relates to issues, as it relates to mentorship, whatever it is? And people just view it as this problem that they have to get through. Oh, I just got to check this box with regard to a medical director. And the medical, and I blame also the MDs and the DOs, because they view it as a money grab as well, where they can just be apathetic and derive passive income just by their licensure and not have any accountability for issues. I mean, I have firsthand experience where a medical director just passed the buck with regard to a complication. Didn't want to have anything to do with it, notwithstanding the role. Wow. So it happens all the time. So going back to what you talked about, it's just to me a mind-boggling how things just tend to be so disparate.
It really is. It's disappointing. You know, it's disappointing. And I think sometimes I see a lot of practitioners who will have a medical director who is a podiatrist or, you know, whatever, OB. They don't know anything about medical aesthetics. So they contact me, or they will contact a friend to try to figure out what to do. And we need to be responsible. Like, we need to be responsible providers. So if you're going to have a provider, if you need a medical director, you better darn well make sure that person, you're paying them to support you. You're paying them to level up and take a problem up to them that they can fix if you can't fix it. And if you don't have a medical provider that's doing that, you better find a new medical provider. It's not all money. Yeah. This is your legal butt. This is your legal butt. So if you don't have somebody you can pass the buck up onto that's going to help take that responsibility and take care of you and help you in a situation, it's not going to help you at all. And you know that, Keith, in a court of law, you know, there are so many different things that, that if we don't send the responsibility up and help to make sure that maybe our director or somebody further in charge, if you're a nurse or something, can help you, then you can really be negligent in certain situations.
The other thing that comes to light, and California, I know, has gotten rid of it, is the non-competes. That aspect to allow, and I know they did it under the guise of access to medical care, that there shouldn't be a restriction with regard to medical care. Where I'm challenged with it now, in Florida, with regard to some clients that we deal with. And I tend to, one of my first discussion points with anybody who wants to open up a practice, I say, okay, well, what documents did you sign with your current employer or your former employer? Because I will tell you that chances are they're going to litigate and try to fight you because of the, revenue that you're bringing in to their practice.
Yeah, in California, we don't have that. It's just kind of a law. You can't hinder someone's ability to work, basically. So, which is fine. That's why I work a mile away. But then again, I don't pull any, revenue from that practice. But so that's kind of nice that there isn't a non-compete in California. But I know I have some colleagues, like in Arkansas, who had to move to a different area for a year out of that bubble of 30 miles, whatever it was. And then move back to where they wanted to actually practice after a year or so, which is really tough.
Yeah, it's I think it's a little bit of a shame because I view it more along the lines of the fact that if a patient wants to go with you, they should be able to go with you. Patients are not property, and you as the practitioner, you don't want a patient who doesn't necessarily want to be with you anyway. Why would you want that? I mean, but it's right. Unfortunately, the bean counters don't look at it that way. The bean counters look at it above board. They look at it along the lines of, no, that's revenue. Whatever we did to get you there, it's the practice. It's not the provider per se.
In California, though, Keith, it's the patients belong to the medical provider.
Yeah.
So it's the physician is the medical provider that owns the practice. I have 49%. My partner is 51. So, legally, the patients belong to him. So I really can't take patients away. They can follow me, but I really can't take patients away. And here's another thing is, if, say, I have an Instagram, which I do, and I've got lots of pictures of patients that I see with this under this clinic name and under this medical director, but I quit and I go to another clinic, those patients have been given their HIPAA consent under that physician and that clinic. So now I've got patients that I'm not legally allowed to have on my Instagram. So there's so many different nuances. Yeah.
And it makes sense. And that's the other people say, well, wait a minute, I'm doing aesthetics. I'm not billing insurance. Why should I even comply with HIPAA? Well, okay. Well, let's see how long that lasts for you doing it that way. it's just crazy. Yeah. Again, the industry and the rogueness of the industry. Let me segue. I've had you on for a long time and I really appreciate our conversation. This is what ends up happening. We get into all these good topics. Right. You mentioned a little bit about your spouse and the support that you've had in regard to your spouse and your careers. Talk a little bit more about that. I know for me personally, if it wasn't for my wife with this podcast, with some of the passions that I have in my career and what I want to do as I approach 60 and beyond, if it wasn't for her, I don't think I'd have that, just those opportunities or that feeling of empowerment to be able to do these different things. I know that you travel a lot. You're mm-hmm. all over the place. How has your spouse been able to be supportive to you, and how do you both manage to handle that?
It's tough. We've been married 37 years, so we've been married a long time. So he is my best friend, and like you with your wife, it's like you enjoy coming home. We work together too. So he runs our school, the Aesthetic Immersion. So he kind of oversees that entire thing. So we drive to work together and he goes over to the school site and I go over to my office, which is right next door to each other. So it's nice being together all the time. And he's always been my biggest supporter. And I wouldn't be a nurse practitioner if it wasn't for him. He was the one that really kind of pushed me that direction and just said, hey, I'll watch the kids. You go up in the room and you study and you get in your office and you just study all weekend. He would take the kids to Disneyland every weekend. He would support me. I always say he's the wind beneath my wings. He is my biggest supporter. He's always encouraged me to fly and to do whatever I want. He's the one that got me into racing cars And he's like, yeah, go play, go race cars. And in my different championships I had racing cars, he was always the one that, you know, like my throttle cable would break. He's like, I got a throttle cable. It's like, no matter what, like he was always there. He was like my savior. So I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. I mean, I wouldn't. And you need someone below you to help you. I would say we don't get here alone. We get here because we stand on the shoulders of others, because they've helped us along the way. This is not an I thing. This is a we thing. You know, none of us would be where we are by ourselves. We wouldn't.
It's so true. I talk about this relationship issue is such a hot topic, and people crave what you have. And God bless you were able to secure that in such an early age during your formative years, and you've sustained so long. And I could tell just by your responses how in love you are and how it's worked mm-hmm. out for you. And you've continued, obviously, to grow together. And the uniqueness, yeah. of course, of it with regard to the relationship both at home and in business is really so admirable. I can also sense the gratitude and admiration and respect that you have for your husband, which, you know, I think it really comes down to in relationships, the respect and allowing each other to be the best version of themselves. And what I mean by that is just, and I shouldn't use the word allowing, supporting, I think is right. a better term. And not trying to quell one's zest for life or one's desire to succeed in certain areas. Allowing you to be a woman, allowing him to be a man, working together and growing and prospering in this blessed world we're in. And so many people, for whatever reason, don't understand that concept or have a hard time reconciling the tightness of the relationship between a man and a woman or two partners in allowing that to grow and sustain. It really takes communication. It takes respect. It takes ongoing difficulties in which each other were able to work through together to the next level. And listen, there's no, you know, magic formula, and there's a lot of difficulties associated with getting, you know, staying in a marriage and being successful and going through it. But like in life, right? There's, you know, it takes work to get to a place. Yeah. So for people who are watching this and listening to this, what's some advice that you can give them? Based on you've been married a lot longer than I've been married, and it took me three times to find the right woman. So what's some advice that you can give some of the folks who are listening or watching this to sustain their relationship or to find the right one?
Oh gosh, that's tough. I think anything in life that is worth anything is worth working for. And it's not that it's easy. And like I always say, you know, you're married when you want them to go home and they are, but like there's times when you don't get along. When you get through really tough times, you don't give up. You're committed to each other, and having that God-given commitment and that respect for each other that even though I don't like you right now, I love you and I'm not going to give up on you. We're going to get through whatever this problem is, whatever disagreement, whatever it is, you're going to get through it. And when you get through tough times, when other tough times hit you, you can fall back and go, you know what? They didn't give up on me and I didn't give up on them when I went through that tough time. So we can make it through this tough time. And you grow and you start to trust each other more and more, and you become more and more committed to each other, and you become more relaxed in your relationship, I should say, like comfortable, because you know that person's going to be there and they're not going to walk away from you. So I think that number one, we believe in God and we are both Christians. I think that that is a huge commitment for us, that our faith is very strong. And I think that that is very, very important in a relationship. I think it's important to be honest and respectful to each other. It's important to trust each other. If you can't trust your spouse, if you can't trust your boyfriend, that's the foundation of a relationship. You've got to have trust.
I love that bullet, the trust, going through difficult times. One of the challenges that many people face is feeling vulnerable. And yeah. the reason why they feel vulnerable or don't want to share their true selves is because they either are regretful of certain things, or they're afraid that this other person is going to judge them. So they don't feel like they're in a safe place. And unfortunately, that is self-limiting in and of itself, because you're never going to be able to be yourself. You're always going to be concerned about, you know, this perception of being judged. Once you can get to a place where you are fully transparent, both of you are fully vulnerable to each other, mm-hmm. in a place where you're allowed to live and be who you are, and also protective of the bubble that you both have created, right? And not allowing the outside to interfere with that bubble that you've created is crucial. Establishing boundaries that are within, among yourselves, whereas you both covet and respect each other and recognize that certain things lines will not be crossed with regard to the relationship that you're in. I'm sure these are some of the topics that we may not verbalize them, but they take place in a healthy relationship.
Well, you know, what's interesting is my husband and I travel a lot. Sometimes I fly every weekend, which in 2024, I'm definitely going to try to back off. He had a heart attack a couple months ago. So I just want to be home more. I don't want to be gone as much.
Oh my gosh. That's right. I forgot to talk to you about that. Yeah.
So I just don't want to be gone as much, and he doesn't want me to be gone as much. So it's fine. It's not his thing. It's just I want to be home more. So I don't want to travel as much, but he always says stuff to me like, you know what? I know guys are hitting on you. They're always looking at you. They're hitting on you, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, they're really not. He's like, you just don't see it, but I see. He stands back. He gets a kick out of it. He stands back and just watches, and he gets a kick out of it. He's not insecure. So, which is good. So I'm like, no, not really, you know, whatever. And I go, you know what? Maybe they do, but I said, you know, my antenna are not up. My antenna aren't up. I don't care. I don't care. I'm not looking for anything. So when your antenna aren't up, it takes two to tango, right? It takes two to tango. So I don't care how much someone flirts. I don't really care, because it's not going to go anywhere, because it takes two people. And we both have that security in each other that we found our soulmates, and that's where we're staying. So, yeah.
I love it. I love it. Well, I really want to take the time. I want to say thank you. I mean, you really shared some really good bullets. And I know it was difficult dealing with the technology, and you're so busy, and we planned ahead to have this, and you gave me some extra time, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate you, Keith. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And congratulations on your amazing podcast. Congratulations. Oh. I appreciate it. And keep it coming, because we love to hear professional people talk and kind of what makes everybody tick. And that's what's fun for us to learn.
Yeah, we're learning, right? We're all learning every day. All right. With that said, thanks for watching and listening. And remember to keep it pro to pro. That's all for today's episode of Pro to Pro. I hope you enjoyed hearing from our guest and gained some valuable insights into the world of entrepreneurship. Like and subscribe to stay up to date with the latest episodes. And don't forget to follow us on social media. Thanks for watching and listening. And remember to keep it pro to pro.